Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the November term of court. The first case for oral argument this morning is Andrew Pearson and others appellants versus Nicole Boggs, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Gary Timpson and Ms. Alexis Warner, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Timpson, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, and for the appellant, we have Mr. Jeff Beck, or the appellee, excuse me, Mr. Jeff Beck, an attorney from Sioux Falls. With that, Mr. Timpson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
I thank you. I thank the court. Good to be here again. Mr. Beck?
I think it's a very simple, straightforward case, Your Honor. It's a qualified immunity case. Both the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and others around the country and the U.S. Supreme Court have spoken often and clearly on the issue of qualified immunity as it relates to Section 1983 liability in the United States. And going way back to Graham versus Connor and other cases, they've said there's specifically a two-point test that you look at. Number one, was the conduct complained of violating a constitutional right? If not, case over. If so, number two, was there an exception, a good faith immunity, which said that even though a right was violated, a reasonable officer would not have been aware of that at the time because the law in that specific situation was not clearly defined at the time. And later court decisions have said, you don't have to decide those one, two, you can decide either one. So it doesn't make any difference whether you decide constitutional violation, qualified immunity based on a reasonable belief. And Judge Hoffman, frankly, got both of them wrong. We'll start with a constitutional violation, Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure. This court, in its state versus deny case, has recognized that there is an emergency exception to the warrant requirement for the Fourth Amendment.
What was the emergency in this case?
A family disturbance, two people bleeding, evidence of a fight, and blood in the entryway of an apartment house, and they needed to go in. It's only reasonable to determine, is there a weapon in there? Is there a perpetrator in there? Is there another victim in there? And if so, they needed to address that. You don't have time to get a warrant if somebody's bleeding out in there. And I would point out further that to my knowledge and that of my able assistant, I don't think that any appellate court or any robust body of judicial knowledge has ever addressed at the federal level the emergency doctrine requirement. But as again, South Dakota Supreme Court has in the deny case, which would lead a reasonable officer to believe in the constitutionality or legality of his actions at the time. And the second, so it was not clearly defined. We have the emergency exception that says it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And if the court were to determine otherwise, there's still no clearly defined body of law or specific case at the time that speaks specifically to it. The U.S. Supreme Court has said repeatedly, you don't define it at a high level, like just they reversed the Ninth Circuit in the Escondido case, saying, no, just saying that you have a Fourth Amendment right is too broadly defined. It must be defined very, very narrowly. And there are a number of cases to that effect. One is the Ehlers case in the Eighth Circuit, which dealt with a Rapid City situation. And the Kelsey case decided, I think after we argued this, but we submitted it to the court, Kelsey, that's K-E-L-S-A-Y, v. Ernst, which
so
is...
So it's not in your brief?
No, it is.
Oh.
It is. I'm sorry, I meant at the trial level. I think we submitted supplemental authority. My apologies.
What wasn't that case dealing more with the excessive force?
Yes, that was in... The police went, and there was a disturbance at a public city swimming pool, and a police was addressing a woman who was, I think, yelling at another woman or something. And then she saw somebody talking to her child, so she turned and started to go to intervene in that situation. The officer said, get back here. And
I'm familiar with the facts. I was just, talking about emergency.
And, so the Supreme Court said you don't have to be a nonviolent felon, a nonviolent misdemeanant who was walking away. It said in Ehlers and in Kelsey, is sufficient reason for an officer to use force, and the degree of force is not measured by the threat. In Eilers, the man was walking away, and the officer just said, get back here, and he wasn't threatening the officer. He just was noncompliant. Officer took him down. In this case, same thing. Officer says to Ms. Kelsey, get back here, come on back here. She doesn't. He grabs. In that case, she was injured. She was rendered unconscious and I think broke a collarbone. And in both of those cases, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said, not a violation. There was no reasonably defined case that would have advised the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, in Mullinex versus Luna.
But you've referenced a case from this court. Doesn't that make it reasonably defined?
I think it that's as to the exception, yes.
Okay.
It does. I think it makes it reasonably defined that there is an emergency doctrine exception in South Dakota to the warrant requirement.
But that set the parameters of it too then, didn't it? It's not just carte blanche.
No, it's not carte blanche. But in response to Justice Curran's question, you have officers that are getting an early morning call of a disturbance. They're screaming and people yelling no in the background, as relayed by the dispatcher. They get there, a bystander says there's a fight going on at that house. They go, they see two males with fresh injuries and bleeding. And as they look at the apartment, the door is ajar, and there's blood in the entryway. And they make the determination that, for the reasons I said, a perpetrator, a victim, a weapon, other evidence might be in there and might not preserve if they allow someone else in there or take the time for a warrant, especially if there's an injured party in there.
You wouldn't necessarily need the emergency exception solely to prevail. There's the additional doctrine recognized and denied, and in other cases, but applied to homes and denied dealing with the role of a community caretaker. Does that apply here? Because the most important part of that is that there can't be, shouldn't be a law enforcement motivation. This should be purely done out of a desire to act in the community caretaking role. Does that apply here?
I think it does. And I think actually South Dakota has kind of merged those doctrines into one, community caretaker in emergency. And certainly knowing that there was a, or the possibility. There's been violence produced blood, you've seen blood, that there could be another injured party in there. I think certainly the community caretaker exception, if you want to parse it from the emergency doctrine, would be applicable as well, Your Honor. So I think you have prong one, no constitutional violation, two clearly acknowledged exceptions. And but the second one is,
well, the
reasonableness of the officer's belief, and I believe Luna versus Mullinex, and I might have those names reversed, I apologize, in the U.S. Supreme Court, doesn't say a reasonable officer. It said every officer would have to have known, by virtue of clearly defining precedent or a robust consensus of authority, and that's not non-existent here. I haven't seen any cases cited by the opposition that said the emergency or community caretaker doctrine weren't valid exceptions, or that, yes, we have clear cases involving somebody doing a warrantless search in those circumstances, and it's not allowed.
I'm interested in your comment that you think we have merged the emergency aid doctrine and the community caretaker doctrine, because in the deny case, the court laid out specific elements that applied to those two tests, and the community caretaker didn't have the emergency component there.
No, I guess what I meant was as to being warrantless exceptions, not being fact specifically different. And I think either one, as Justice Salter may have, in response to his questions, would equally apply here. You have somebody bleeding out in there.
So I'm interested in your take on just applying the community caretaker doctrine, because, of course, we have disputed facts, the opponent, or arguably disputed facts, what the circuit court found. So as to the issue of whether there is an emergency under the viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the entrance into the apartment wasn't until 20 minutes after they arrived. There's a dispute as to, you know, what level of emergency actually existed 20 minutes after they got there. So could you just address the community caretaker and how you think that right is clearly established to enter under that provision under undisputed facts in this case?
Yeah, I think so, Your Honor. I mean, I can envision the situation where, okay, we won't we'll go call a judge, get a warrant, we come back. Later, we finally get the warrant, we come in, and somebody's bled out and they're dead. I'd be hearing a different lawsuit against the police. I think when you see clearly what confronted those officers that night in the early, early morning hours, that there's been a fight, there's been an independent witness reporting a fight, sufficiently concerned that they made an emergency call. The emergency call indicates, I'll say, some unrest or disturbance in the background, somebody yelling no and people yelling, and they get there and they see two people, two males, freshly injured and bleeding near the what was directed to be the right apartment, because the initial apartment they went to was based on a GPS finding because it was an anonymous call. But the independent witness said, no, the call's over there, that's where the fight is. So the, where the actual disturbance, fight, had occurred, they go there. As I said, they see two freshly injured individuals, and they see blood in the doorway, and I think that is reasonable to say we need to get in there and see community caretaker, somebody injured. Which I think also be the emergency doctrine as well. Injured person what might require care, neither of which are law enforcement specific exceptions.
The arrival of 17 officers on the scene.
With all respect, Your Honor, nothing. I mean, they sued three officers. You know, I think it's immaterial as to whether or not there's a constitutional violation if there are three officers or 20. I just don't think it. There's no indication that any of these officers surround them, brandished weapons, tried to cordon the area off, anything like that. I think any time officers get to what might be a violent situation, other available officers naturally will respond to see if assistance is needed and kind of stand back and stand down. I think that's what happened here. So I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I don't think it plays into this case at all, the number of officers that were there. So, I mean, there's not one case that we cited, I don't think, that Judge Hoffman considered. In two very recent Eighth Circuit cases, very recent U.S. Supreme Court cases that were very, very specific on the issue of qualified immunity in the Fourth Amendment context, unreasonable search and seizure and excessive force. And his decision, frankly, goes against virtually every case I think that we cited, except there was one in the Eighth Circuit, which the U.S. Supreme Court reversed because the Ninth Circuit had defined the constitutional right involved at too high a level.
Can you explain, Mr. Timson, why you think the circuit court erred on the excessive force claim in finding that there was a material facts in dispute as to that prong?
Yes, I think so. I think the Ehlers case in the Eighth Circuit addresses that, as well as the Kelsey case. Those cases, involved certainly as equal or, in the Kelsey case, greater force than was alleged in this case. And the Eighth Circuit said in last year, in 2019, that this woman simply walking away in a public area near a swimming pool and not responding to an officer's statement, get back here, was sufficient in the qualified immunity context to justify what I'll call a spin takedown, resulting in this woman losing consciousness and having her collarbone broken. And the same thing as Ehlers, gentleman's walking away in Rapid City, and the officer says, get back here. He doesn't. And the officer gets in, and again, that's kind of a pretty aggressive takedown to the ground.
One of the facts you mentioned there, I do think, appears to be key to those decisions, and it's the officers issuing the command to stop or to get back here. And don't we have a dispute in this case between what the officers say they told Ms. Boggs versus what she denied that there was a command for her not to go into the apartment? So how do we jump to where you want us to get here?
The inference most favorable in the ordinary summary judgment case, let's say in a negligence case or that sort of thing, is a bit different here, because the standard is not whether or not there are disputed facts. The standard is whether or not a reasonable officer, every reasonable officer, would have believed in the propriety or legality of his or her action at the time. The officer said, no, I went in, and she started to follow. And here, the level of force, to go back to your earlier question, too, was The officer grabbed her and fell. He did not do an intentional takedown on her. And I don't think that matters in dispute. But I said, I think we go back to test one.
Well,
no
one,
constitutional violation based on the exceptions.
No dispute as to one officer falling, but with regard to the other officer is the one that is alleged to have done, or at least part of the takedown there. And it appeared to be very disparate facts that were alleged by both sides here. So what is the court to do with that?
I think the court is to do what the U.S. Supreme Court and the vast majority of federal appellate courts have done and say it's not a he said, she said. It's regardless of which version did this officer reasonably believe that his actions were lawful and constitutional based on existing precedent, either specifically or by what they call a robust consensus of authority. And so I think it's not, like I said, the usual he said, she said, whoops, we got a fact question. I think it's when this officer says this, was his belief in that reasonable, even if erroneous?
When he says what?
When he says she followed him into the apartment.
So the mere following him into the apartment, in your view, would be sufficient to do a takedown?
Well, I don't know about a takedown. I think it'd do a restraint. I think it's no more than in Ehlers or Kelsey.
Well, but her version is that it was a takedown. I understand there's a completely opposite version by the officers, but in viewing summary judgment, don't we have to view the facts in light of the plaintiff's version here?
Well, I think you do, but I think the legal test is not whether or not there's a difference in versions. The difference is whether or not the officer's belief was reasonable if, in fact, there was a violation in the first instance, which I don't believe there was here, given emergency and caretaker exception, exceptions.
Going into the home, the excessive force claim would pick up at the point in which the officers redirect or put their hands on Ms. Boggs and move her out, and one way or another that results in her going down. It seems to me that as I look at the record, there's acknowledgement in the plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment that Officer Tolan did fall, but it's clear that Ms. Boggs said that Officer Pearson threw her to the ground. I think that's the verb, threw her to the ground. So, and that's obviously different than what the police officers say. So I'm interested in your reaction to that. And the second part of that is, what's in this record in terms of what's revealed by the reports that were made by the officers as to whether Ms. Boggs initiated and was the aggressor by pushing one of the officers. There was some testimony in the criminal trial. We read from the briefs that that wasn't accurate. So what do we do with that? If the test is ultimately whether a police officer reasonably believed that his conduct complied with the law, what do we do with the idea that possibly one of the reports wasn't accurate? What is that? What could that mean?
Well, I think, first of all, the evidence of that is some allegations about a subsequent criminal trial. And we all know that the mere fact that somebody's acquitted does not approve or lead to an unconstitutional police action. If it did, police wouldn't arrest anybody.
I'm not talking about the result of the trial. I'm talking about the evidence in the trial. And I don't know if that's even in this record. We read about it.
I don't recall it being in there. I'm not going to. So I don't recall it being in there. And I'll leave it at that. But in any event, I think it's like the number of police cars. I think it's immaterial. The instance is, in two cases, Ehlers and Kelsey, we're not talking about a dispute between a takedown, even if she says it was an intentional takedown. And the court acknowledged specifically that the takedowns in Ehlers and Kelsey were intentional. They were an actual physical police maneuver to take down and still found immunity. So I'll conclude with the less than couple minutes I have by saying, number one, I think due to the emergency and caretaker exceptions, prong number one, constitutional violation, no, which is the end of the case. It always has been since qualified immunity. If the court gets beyond that, which I don't think it should, I think you have to look at, were the actions of these officers such that every reasonable officer, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, would have known they were unlawful. I submit not. So I think count one, the constitutionality ends the inquiry. But I think beyond that, I think Kelsey and Ehlers are instructive and probably determinative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. Mr. Beck, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Beck from Sioux Falls. I represent Nicole Boggs. I have been with this trial from the beginning. I was her trial counsel at the criminal court level and have been with this case now since essentially August 19th of 2016 when, as Justice Kern said, 17 police officers from the Sioux Falls Police Department went to her house and violated her constitutional rights. During that arrest, they arrested her, they arrested two of her sons, and Ms. Boggs was acquitted at trial. The next trial on her son was an acquittal, and the third one, they...
Does whether it's an acquittal or a conviction have any relevance here?
Where I would say the relevance would come in is when we look at sort of a test. The city went to Allers and Kelsey, and in there they talk about what did the person do, what crime did they commit, and here the crime that they charged her with was obstructing, and it's already been brought up to this court that the obstructing was essentially that she followed them into the house. Now it is clearly disputed whether or not they told her she couldn't go into the house. At the time that she did enter her own house, and I'm going to actually take one step back. One thing that that counsel failed to ignore was the fact that there was not a call to the Boggs' residence. There was the officers right away when they first got there start saying, somebody in this house called 911, we're coming in. And they say, our policy says we're coming in. And that was the dialogue that just continued.
So are you, do you challenge the underlying fact that there was a 911 call that was either a hang up or it was unknown from an unknown origin? I mean, are you okay with that fact?
Yeah, I 100%. I agree with it. There was a 911.
That's what brought them there. They didn't just like show up. That's what brought them there.
Correct. So the initial 911 call. Yes, Justice. The 911 call came, and the record shows from somebody named Ortega. They initially dispatched officers to the Ortega location on East 8th Street, some couple miles away. While officers are going there, they then change the location and say, oh, we've pinged the phone, and now it is at a location within 60 meters of like 4513 East Ashbury Place. And if the court recalls, Ms. Boggs lives at 4517. The East Ashbury complex it's a 110-unit apartment complex that encompasses five buildings. Ms. Boggs' unit has, I believe, 12. I believe it's 12 or 18 in her unit specifically. And so this 911 call that they said, well, we think the phone is located within 25 meters now of this 4513 building, which is a building next to Ms. Boggs' building. Officers respond to that location. There's some people outside. They ask them if they hear anything, and they say, well, we heard something up the street. They then go up to the next building. That's where they get to Ms. Boggs' unit. Outside of Ms. Boggs' unit is her son, and he's standing there with his shoes off. And the officer says, what's going on? He says, I'd like to get my shoes. So the son goes up, knocks on the door. Ms. Boggs answered. At the time...
Wasn't there blood on the sidewalk?
There was. There's about five drops. But it wasn't...
Well, I mean, we don't go by volume here. I mean, what were the police supposed to do? Turn around, walk away, and say, have a nice day?
No. And they can certainly ask or inquire about the blood. One of the issues that I guess I have with that is the location. It was argued that it was in the entryway to the apartment. And it wasn't in the entryway to the apartment. It was on a sidewalk leading up to a building that has 60 units. And, yes, outside was Brendan Conlon. And Brendan Conlon said at some point, this was, I believe, like 12 to 17 minutes later, that he said, he goes, it's from me. And he lifted up his shirt and showed, like, scratches and said, yeah, he said, that's mine.
So the blood was sourced to that location?
Well, no, not to the location, to the person that was outside. To nobody inside.
Of this one.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that's mine. He said I was wrestling with my brother.
Your argument, just keep in mind, maybe the
take your water up there. It's handier.
Keep What's in that? Mind the community caretaker exception, for instance, which requires some degree of articulable facts that will justify the intrusion. So, is your argument based upon what you were talking to us about concerning facts? Is your argument that they lacked sufficient articulable facts to engage what we recognize to be an exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement? Is that your argument?
Yes. They didn't have, the city's argued that they had either the community caretaker or emergency aid doctrine to go in. If we look at emergency aid, one of the key things there is an emergency. In the two cases that were cited, the Kelsey and Ernst, those dealt with the takedown. As far as the emergency aid, deny, I believe is what counsel just put forth on. Deny, the key there, you didn't have anybody at the house. Officers show up, they notice this odor of ammonia. They think that it is so strong that somebody could have potentially succumbed to this odor. So they just quit going to check, make sure that nobody's injured, and step out. That's it.
So when we apply the community caretaker doctrine, Mr. Beck, you know, you're absolutely right. The scenario in Deny was much different than what we have here. And what we have here seems to be sort of probably a rather typical response to a called-in domestic dispute, or at least the circumstances that were presented would suggest that possibility. So where in the language imposed in Deny or any of the cases can we get to the clearly established right that these particular circumstances faced by an officer under this test, and in the community caretaker in particular, which doesn't reference an emergency, how do we get to the clearly established right part of that, that it would signal to reasonable officers that no reasonable officers could think they could go in under the community caretaker under that circumstance?
The fundamental right that we get back to there is where the court has spoken and said that a search inside a person's home, absent a warrant, is per se unreasonable unless you have a clearly delineated exception. We don't have that here. The emergency aid doctrine requires an emergency. Here, we've got the homeowner. We've got Miss Boggs.
Well, I'm talking about community caretaker in particular.
Okay, on community caretaker, again, we've got Miss Boggs. She's there. She has the ability to, she says, here's who's here. It's my four sons. And there's nothing going on.
So is it unreasonable for officers not to believe the person at the door when they respond to a domestic?
But they weren't responding to a domestic. I mean, this is... That's where I need to get the court back to. They weren't sent to this location. I mean, nobody from this location summoned them. It's not like a domestic where the wife calls and the cops get there and potentially the husband's hiding behind the door. We don't have that.
Surely that would be a justification if the officers found something once they were there lawfully. That distinction that you're making would not justify the officers turning around and saying, well, we weren't dispatched here for a domestic dispute, so I guess we'll turn a blind eye to everything that's revealing itself in front of us. Because, I mean, that suggests a rather myopic view of what the officers are seeing and assessing. And to me, it seems more important that the officers are able to articulate some justification to support the entry under the doctrine we've already recognized.
Correct. And if you go to... when we say the doctrine, and they talk about that, here you're getting more to the emergency, or actually the community caretaker. There's got to be some set of articulable facts. Here, the articulable facts that the officers attempted to put out was, you know, the time of day, that it was 3:30 in the morning. Okay, that, you know, they said that there was a call. Well, again, there wasn't a call. So we're going to go, it's going to start to get disputed. There wasn't blood in the entryway of the apartment. There's blood out on a sidewalk. You had all of the players that were present. The Boggs family said, because the officer started his cell right at the beginning, was, we've got a 911 hang up. We're coming in your house. Our policy says that. And I put it in the brief sort of there, I think it was with Judge Hoffman, and it was like the old Miller Lite commercial, tastes great, less filling, tastes great, less filling. You had them standing outside saying, okay, officers, if that's your policy, verify that the call came from inside and you can go inside and check. Just please call the dispatcher, verify that a 911 hangup come in, and you can go in and look and make sure everybody's okay and get the heck out of here. Just
so how does the dispatch log that's in the record here come into play with the view of the facts? Because there's several entries in that dispatch log. One of them refers to a number coming back to a Facebook listing for Cody Boggs.
If those are what gets typed into the computer, and so that's really key to what I was getting at, is for them to call. If they thought, if their claim, they claim that the 911 call came from inside the house. If that's the case, call it back. Your policy says that's what you do. One of the first things on their 911 hangup policy is call the number back, attempt to initiate contact, and then you sort of move down this list. And they didn't do that. Instead, they sat outside for 28 minutes and argued with the Boggs family of whether or not they had the legal authority to go in. And at one point, now we've got 17 cops there. We've got four of her boys, two of which are minors, handcuffed on the floor. But then you've got Ms. Boggs, free to move about. Twice, she went from the apartment complex over to her garage, rifled around tubs. So clearly, if they're going to attempt to articulate that she's some threat to them, because again, we've got three things that they need to look at, right? What was the nature of the crime? Was she attempting to flight, you know, or evade arrest? And was she actively resisting? Well, they're not even controlling her. They're not scared of her.
I do want to, before you run out of time, Mr. Beck, have you address your theory of the city's liability here, because I was somewhat uncertain given the nature of the complaint. You have a separate negligent hiring and training count, which, as I understand, it didn't appear that was before the circuit court. And then you have the separate 1983 claim against the city, which appears to allege the same type of conduct. Can you articulate for me specifically what the theory of the city's liability is?
Justice Devaney, what the theory of the city's liability goes to, again, I totally agree and I understand, and I'm not arguing to this court, respondent superior or vicarious liability, that's not the argument. The argument is a city policyholder can be held liable under the 1983 action for the acts of their employees via a single endorsed act. It does not have to be a carte blanche policy that, you know, they don't have to set out to violate the rights of a person. That's not what they have to do, but they can endorse it. Here, as and I would arguendo, Judge Hoffman found validly that 17 officers there, the reason three were named, it was Pearson, who first grabbed her, and Toland. And then the next officer that entered the house was the sergeant who was supervising the scene. And so that's why you've got Toland, Pearson, and Hoffman. The other 14 officers weren't named, but collectively as a group, and so then with Sergeant Hoffman standing there, they endorsed that behavior. Here we've got a clearly established right, a nonviolent misdemeanant, not attempting to flee. She's inside of her own house, standing on the entryway of her own house, holding a binder full of papers, when suddenly, without warning, officer grabs her. She screams out. The officer grabs then from the other side. That's Toland. He then falls. He slips on the rug. While he's down on the ground, he pulls. They pull from essentially two different directions. One breaks an arm. The other dislocates a shoulder. She screams out, and I think
I'm sorry. I just don't want you to run out of time here. So let's assume all of those facts under her version, and there was there was an unconstitutional takedown, excessive use of force here under those facts. And your notion that a single endorsed act can trigger the city's liability. The cases that you cite also seem to imply that has to be an act by a policymaker, or you have to somehow tie it to a policy of the city. So explain how in this scenario, a single act by these officers, including a sergeant, would get to that level to trigger city liability.
The policymaker arguably in this situation was Sergeant Hoffman. He has the ability to make decisions, control what happens for the city. He was then tasked not only with being present on the scene and making sure that his officers complied with the meaning the constitutional rights of the citizens, he was also then tasked with investigating it and looking at the use of force because that was used, and he then had to follow a there's sort of a guideline, and in doing that, it required him to go through a series of steps that he had to do to address the use of force issue by a city police officer. And in going through that process, I want to say ignored it, but he did ignore it. I mean, you've got these videotapes and audio tapes of all the officers. They've all got body mics on. So you've got individual audio from each of them. Toland goes back to the push, where there's a disputed piece of fact regarding the push. And Pearson asked Toland, did she push you? And he goes, no, I fell down on the rug. Then he turns and writes in his report that he pushed. Then he goes to a criminal trial and testifies that she was obstructing because she used physical force by pushing Officer Toland.
And again, I'm gonna assume all that. I still go back to the single act notion. So, and how does it equate to a policy that the city endorsed for the Sioux Falls Police Department? You know, because that appears to be quite a discretionary investigation then that takes place, where the look at the actual policy for what you're entitled to do for excessive force and then apply the facts. So I'm still having trouble with that notion.
By endorsing the behavior, and Hart v. Miller is where I would direct this court to. And Hart v. Miller had said that there's got to be a showing that the supervisor encouraged the specific incident or misconduct or in some other way directly participated in it, and that they implicitly authorized it or knowingly acquiesced to that unconstitutional conduct. So here you've got, so that is the vehicle by which the city then becomes liable for a single act of that employee. And that's what you got. You got Sergeant Hoffman. He's the policymaker. He's the one that I think this court addressed, somewhat similar, just had it before the court in the Yankton PD case, where it talks about hiring authority, you know, in the various levels within the police department and who's got what authority. And here, this is, he's got the authority to discipline these employees. He's got the authority to initiate removal action against the employees. He's got the ability to a duty to investigate the use of force complaints. He was present on the scene. He's standing there. He's standing over the shoulder. And once he failed in that duty to endorse these fictitious reports, and that became an endorsement of a single act that would put liability on the city. And I hope that answers the justice's question. As far as the word there we'd probably use is ratification, and that's what they did. Stepping back, then going to clearly established, the bright line rule that we look at is, again, if you've got a nonviolent misdemeanor, they're not using any type of force against anybody, per se unconstitutional. You have such a situation here. Distinguishable from Ehlers, distinguishable from Kelsey, they're outside. This person is essentially fleeing, disregarding the officer's warnings. They've been told, you're under arrest. Here, we don't have those facts. We've got Ms. Boggs standing in her house, holding these papers, and they grab her and take her down. The case that I directed this court to take a look at, that A, we've got this clearly established rule, would go to look at Thornton. In Thornton, you've got, again, a nonviolent misdemeanor. He's walking down the sidewalk. Officer comes up behind him, tackles him to the ground. Court says, that's unconstitutional. You take Rockusek versus Jansen, which was one that was, I believe that was Mr. Timpson's case here not too long ago, 8th Circuit. in that one. Same thing. You had the individual handcuffed in booking. Officer doesn't like what he says. Officer picks him up, drops him down the ground, and knocks out a couple teeth. And he's compliant. There's nothing he did there. There's nothing that Ms. Boggs did there. We would request that that this court affirm the decision of the lower court.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. Mr. Timpson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
I thank the court. As to...
And Mr. Timpson, please use a microphone because we're on the internet.
Oh, yeah, certainly, Your Honor. As to the liability of the city itself as an entity, I appreciate Justice Devaney's insight into that issue. It requires more than a single act. It has to be a policymaker, a supervisor, a shift supervisor, if that's what he was, because there was probably a captain and a lieutenant on duty that night as well, is not a policymaker. They are a supervisor. And beyond that, I would just rely on the statements in our brief as to that. As to the dispute of facts, was she told she couldn't go in? I would refer to the record and the defendants, plural, statement of undisputed material facts at number 7, where Officer Toland explained the first time, and I'm paraphrasing, Officer Toland again explained due to the call he needed to enter the apartment. The response was admit, but qualify that she had requested verification that the 9/11 call emanated from that apartment. But she does not deny that she was told the first and second time. Our statement of undisputed material facts number 11, and the response, again paraphrasing, when Mrs. Boggs returned to her apartment, she stated that Officer Toland could not enter. Officer Toland explained for the third time that he needed to enter the apartment and also explained that if she would not let him in, she would be arrested for obstruction. Response, admit Mrs. Boggs told the officer she didn't want them going into her house, but deny the absence of any physical interference. She does not deny that she was told three times not to go in. Now, I don't think if you look at Ehlers and Kelsey, because somebody's walking away, not running, in a public area and disregarding a command, that is a, quote, flight. Certainly the physical injury in Kelsey was as significant, if not more so, than here.
Is there a difference between her or telling them they're going in and her not letting them in versus them, as opposed to them telling her, you can't go in with us either?
Well, I think it's, again, a public safety issue. It's a caretaking thing. If there's a violent perpetrator in there and they don't know that.
And I have no, you know, it's not the question of whether they had a reason not to let her come in. It's whether they told her she couldn't come in.
Well, I think I just said that in our statement of undisputed material facts, that number 7, let me look here. Ms. Boggs stated that Officer Toland told her, Officer Toland told, could not come into the apartment. Well, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. But due to his call, he had to enter the apartment, and Mrs. Boggs said that she could not without a warrant. So, no, I don't think there's direct evidence of that, but there again, I don't think there's clearly established authority out there, as we've discussed, that would lead a reasonable officer to believe that failing to do that amounted to a constitutional deprivation. So she was told repeatedly that she was not to go in there. And the Yellow Boy case is clearly distinguishable. There you had an officer arrive at a situation and saw a young man walking down the street. There was no indication whatsoever that he was involved, maybe even aware of the reason for the call. Without warning, without command, anything, that officer came up and tackled the young boy from around and threw him to the sidewalk. He had no suspicion that he was involved or that any illegal or improper activity had gone on, and he issued no commands. That case is totally severable from anything we've cited in our briefs or any of the facts as established in this case. So there again, I think, as I said, as to the city, there's no evidence that Hoffman was a supervisor or a policymaker, and that if he did, that he otherwise acquiesced or did anything else. He got there after the fact, after the fall or takedown, as you want to characterize it, had occurred.
and duly reported in his report. There's no evidence that the city of Sioux Falls, per Monell and his progeny, has any policy, custom, or usage that tolerates or countenances routine constitutional deprivation by its police officers. So I think you've got the situation where officers come to a 911 call, and I don't know if the particular locus, other than your reference to the Facebook, could have been ascertained at that time, because the dispatcher didn't know. They defined it by a GPS signal to be within, a 25-yard or rather narrow proximity. Got there, an independent bystander says there's a fight going on over there. That's where it is, and so the officers go over there. They see not one but two young men bleeding. They see, if you want to call it the cement, the entryway, I believe it's a slab-on-grade construction, so it's probably there's some continuity between the interior subfloor and the outside area, and there's some blood there. And as the Chief Justice pointed out, I think the volume of blood is not determinative of whether or not there's a constitutional violation. You know, some people have gunshot wounds that don't bleed much at all. And you cut yourself shaving and bleed quite a bit. So I don't think that's the determinative factor. I think the overall question is, number one, was there a constitutional violation? And I say no. There is a recognized exception in this state and federally to a caretaker and emergency care doctrine thing, which I think were validated in this case. Known violence, blood, bloodshed, and an apartment door ajar. Is somebody hurt in there? The second question is, can the person, the tenant, in this case, Nicole Boggs, go in if there's a perpetrator and there she might be at further risk? So I think it was prudent and certainly not clearly established by existing law, so clearly defined that an officer couldn't tell her to stay out. So I think there's no constitutional violation in the first instance. In the second instance, the conduct here complained of, and I'm not going to say admitted, complained of by the plaintiff, is not conduct that was so clearly proscribed by existing law as it would enable every officer to know that that right was established and that his or her conduct was a violation. I think the case should be reversed, and I thank the court for its time and attention this morning. Justice Salter.
Before you go, question for the record, and I'll try to guide you to this so as to not put you on the spot. I'm interested in what you had to say about this now and also below. So one of the statements of undisputed material fact that was a part of the plaintiff's partial motion for partial judgment, dealing with Officer Pearson's report, I'll take you to sort of that topic. The statement that was alleged to be undisputed by Ms. Boggs was that Officer Pearson provided sworn testimony regarding the policy and training received by the Sioux Falls Police Department, which he used to justify his actions. Here, this is the part I'm interested in. But later admitted that such an assertion was an untruthful statement and that no such policy existed. Then the following one is that Officer Pearson put in his arrest report that Ms. Boggs pushed Officer Tolan, which is contrary to what Officer Tolan told him that night. Your response was that you admitted that Officer Pearson testified during the criminal trial regarding officer safety and in certain situations being allowed to refuse entry of occupants in their homes while while search is being conducted. So that was the one about the policy. It's not a policy, but sometimes it's practice. That's the way I read that one. But then you said that on the false report, the inaccurate report, you said that Officer Pearson indicated in his report that Ms. Boggs had pushed Officer Tolan. And he later said that was his perspective. Can you help me understand? I know we're way in the weeds on this, but I want to know what your position is on the significance of this allegedly inaccurate report, whether that's material in terms of how we examine someone doing.
No, I don't think it's material for this reason. First of all, a lot of those reports are dictated from the squad car, over the radio, or otherwise by electronic means, and then are reviewed with a supervisor later and sometimes revised. In the heat of the action, when you've got this situation going on, we've got a stabbing, we've got some blood evidence, we want to look in this apartment, no, you can't come in. I think it's very easy to make a mistake or misstate as to slip or fall or push. I'm not saying that's what happened. By way of you asking for my explanation or understanding, and I think that's easy to...
Would you agree with me at least on this? Maybe you have a different view. But if the idea was, if the report was that Ms. Boggs pushed and sort of like suggesting maybe she was the aggressor, that's a lot different from just falling down with Officer Tolan as he falls down. Would you agree with that?
I think it's a lot different, but again, I don't think constitutionally it's material in the light of Kelsey, especially. You know, and the final thing I guess I would like to say is that you know, I think it hinges on whether or not constitutional deprivation or right violation occurred in the first instance in light of the caretaker and emergency doctrines, and I think not. I think that's dispositive. And again, I thank the court much for its attention and time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.